Okay, let's begin. So, was anybody here during the day when I began last week? You were. Okay, so you'll just have to put up with this. I think it's always useful when we're talking about detailed halachos to appreciate the role of Durabanans, not only in the laws of Shabbos, but in all areas of Jewish law. Very, very important to get the concept, because I think that there is prevalent in certain minds a disposition towards certain institutions of rabbinic law, which inappropriately is encouraged by the concept in Jewish law itself, which is that a drabbanan, a rabbinic law, is treated lakula, is treated leniently. And so from there, some people gain the misapprehension that rabbinic law is somehow not that significant. And so I find it useful to address straightforwardly the whole question of rabbinic law, because what we're going to be studying tonight and in this course really is mostly a body of rabbinic law. Meaning that according to the Torah, there's one thing you can't do on Shabbos: cook. So if you're not cooking, there's a lot of things you can do with heat that are not cooking. And the rabbis came along and ruined our fun and said that we can't use heat in a lot of ways because of different concerns. And so, were it not for drabbanans on Shabbos, you and I would not recognize Shabbos observance. If somebody kept only d'oraisas, only Torah laws, and not rabbinic law on Shabbos, you and I would think that they are absolutely not Shabbos observant. There'd be no muksa, right? So they'd be moving things around. They'd be moving pens freely, nails, hammers, etc. According to many opinions, they would be turning lights on Shabbos. Some people actually maintain that an electric light is only a rabbinic prohibition. It's not the prevalent approach, but that's one opinion. There are many, many things. Handling money, according to most opinions, except for the Ramban, is a rabbinic prohibition. All kinds of business discussions and so on and so forth, even business deals, would be a rabbinic prohibition. There'd be all kinds of use of heat on Shabbos that we don't that we're not allowed to avail ourselves of, that we would see it happening. As a matter of fact, does anybody know that there is a modern day case where a person would only keep Shabbos on Torah law and not keep Shabbos on rabbinic law nowadays? This is like a cute little Shabbos afternoon riddle.
Ethiopians?
What's that? Yeah, but they would be wrong. They'd be nice people who are making a mistake because they don't have rabbinic law. But they'd be governed by it, they just don't know it. But there's a case where the halacha would say that you keep Shabbos in a d'oraisa way, but not in a d'rabbanan way.
Like Noah hydrolls, or somebody learning to become Jewish,
cute.
Not yet Jewish.
I didn't think of that. No, but that guy's a person who is not Jewish really is not allowed to keep Shabbos at all. And in order to practice and get into it, they keep everything except for a law. But it's not necessarily rabbinic or Torah law. They just don't keep some part of Shabbos so that they don't.
How about astronauts?
Astronauts, to whatever degree they're obligated to keep Shabbos, if they are, then they would have to keep the whole deal. So it's really not fair. I'm cheating. If a person is in a zone of Earth where the question is if it's halachically Shabbos or Sunday, so we tell a person to keep Shabbos on what most people think is Shabbos, and on Sunday when some people think it's Shabbos, so we say a suffix d'oraisa l'chumra. It's a question of a d'oraisa, and therefore you have to take the severe approach and assume it's Shabbos. But when it comes to rabbinic prohibitions, you don't have to keep them. So you keep 2 days Shabbos, and the second day you're keeping only the d'oraisas and not the rabbanas. Okay, that's the case. So many people, for example, in Hawaii, you don't really want to be in Hawaii on Sunday. You really don't. Because there are many opinions that would say that it's not Sunday, it's Shabbos. It's anywhere between the eastern end of Australia, the eastern coast of Australia, and Hawaii is in an area of the world which is not clear. We're not sure where the halachic dateline is, and therefore where day. So anyway, wherever that area is, that's where you would keep Shabbos the second day so to speak, the rice is not Drabonis. Anyway, let's get to this. So what's this deal with rabbinic law? What are the rabbis? Are they just spoil sports? Are they just obsessive compulsive? Do they not trust Jews to keep Torah law? Are they always worried that we're going to come to violate things and therefore they increase the bans? What exactly is the deal here? So I don't want to go through all the documentation of this, but I just want to put forward an argument. Maybe it's not original to you, but it's worth repeating when we deal with rabbinic law. And that is that the rabbis are an expression of the collective consciousness of the Jewish people. And that means that the rabbis, in introducing certain bans, actually express the preoccupation and the obsession of the Jewish people to conform to the will of God. So the way it works is this. There comes a point in Jewish history, in Jewish development, where our sensitivity to what God wants out of a day or out of a ritual or out of an observance is dulled. And because our sensitivity becomes dulled collectively, we require a behavioral boost, so to speak, which would artificially, enact an attitude that beforehand would have already been there. So that the day we got the laws of Shabbos, we didn't get drabbanans. So the day we got the laws of Shabbos, we had no prohibition, for example, of mukzah. Nobody said you can't move an item that whose purpose is a violation of Shabbos, that you can't move that item. There is no such law in the Torah. There is, however, a rabbinic law that says you can't do that. So there was a time when the Jewish people collectively approached Shabbos with such care and such caution and such zeal and such conscientiousness and such presence that it was inconceivable that they could ever come to that, and therefore it wasn't necessary at that point. At a later point, the body politic, so to speak, the mouth of the Jewish people in the form of the rabbis, the sages, determined that certain institutions were required in order to protect us from a certain mental lapse or a certain drifting from full consciousness and full awareness of what it is that a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants from us in certain things. And so they institute Drabbanans. So, for example, when the rabbis institute the idea of washing before food, that's not a Torah law. No Torah law that says you have to wash before food. The rabbis are aware that at a certain point in history, given our distance from the temple, a lack of familiarity with the temple, our lack of need to practice certain laws of defilement, that we would lose the whole deal. And therefore they instituted a thing that helps us remember that there are certain cases in Jewish life where hands have to be ritually pure and you have to be very careful about what you're touching before you touch it. What would that be? That would be temple, certain foods related to the temple, and so on and so forth. So by instituting that, they restore a certain frame of mind that used to exist independently and that wasn't necessarily required. The power that the rabbis have to do this, of course you're familiar with that, but I remind you of it for the purpose of appreciating what they're doing here, which is that one pasuk refers to the concept of a mishmeres, of a protectorate, where the rabbis are required to create protective measures to guard the Torah. So the question is, when the day that they create that measure, why didn't they do it the day before, right, or the generation before, or 100 years before, or 300 years before? The idea is that at a certain point, they recognize that this takana, this repair, that's literally what a takana is, a rabbinic institution called Takana, is a repair. It's a repair of a state of mind. It helps, through legislation, restore a state of mind which might otherwise have been there. So when it comes to Shabbos law, it's the same thing. Rabbinic law is really our best access to the power of Shabbos, because we would otherwise have drifted from the full impact of what God wants from us when He describes the Holy Shabbos and its prohibitions. And we would, perhaps because of our lack of connect, or relative lack of connection, we would inadvertently violate Shabbos more often. And that inadvertent violation of Shabbos might not even bother us because, A, it happened more often, therefore you become dulled to the sensitivity of what it is to inadvertently violate the King's Day, and we would come to misunderstand certain Torah prohibitions because we would see things happening that look like Torah prohibitions and we would become desensitized to it. So therefore the rabbis, in expressing these prohibitions and in legislating these prohibitions, actually resensitize us to Shabbos and restore a sense of reverence for the basic package of Shabbos that was given to us in the Torah. So that's the idea of the of Drabbanans. And therefore the Drabbanans are really the way to access the Torah. They're really a method to hold on to the power of the Torah. And a true God-fearing Jew actually treasures Drabbanans. He actually treasures these legislations of the rabbis because they represent the way to gain a consciousness about the basic package itself. By the way, studying the laws of Shabbos not only has a practical value of familiarizing a person with all of the myriad details of the laws of Shabbos, and as the Chafetz Chaim says in his introduction to the laws of Shabbos in the Mishnah Berurah, that if a person doesn't routinely review the laws of Shabbos, he's going to inevitably, unintentionally transgress something because there are just so many details. And unless you take Dr. Leder's approach of being extremely conservative and doing nothing except just staring at your food on Shabbos, even there you could theoretically violate the law. So therefore, not only does it have a practical value, but it also has the value of restoring a sense of reverence and awareness for Shabbos. Shabbos is such a treasure, such a gift, and we approach it once a week, and it's also a burden, and therefore we often have a certain mental barrier to some of the observances of Shabbos. And so studying the laws actually wakes you up, so to speak. It just not only practically helps you observe better, but it also sensitizes you and makes you aware, it gives you access, so to speak, to the message of Shabbos and to the care and caution that we have to have on Shabbos. Okay. By the way, I've always felt that the details of halacha in general, but particularly the overwhelming and inescapable assault of halacha that a Jew encounters on Shabbos, is the greatest compliment that God could possibly give us. Because what God is saying is, you think that you are a sleepwalker who goes through life with a few moments of awareness and awakeness? I want you to know what you're capable of. You're capable of spending an entire day thinking about whether or not you can cut your fingernail absentmindedly, whether you can bite your lip, whether you can pull a hair out of your head, or whether you can move a pencil across the surface of the table for 25 hours. You're capable of being aware of every single thing. That's how grand you are as a human being. And so it's a divine compliment to a human being. And Shabbos is an unbelievable lesson besides all the other things that Shabbos is. It's an unbelievable lesson in the human capacity to be focused and to be present. And it's a very, very powerful thing when a human being starts realizing how often he drifts into, like, you know, into hours sometimes of a separation from where he is at that moment. You know, we were talking about the cell phones before. Okay, anyway, secondly, and I pointed this out last week as well, whenever you study halacha, you find things that you're doing wrong. That's just the nature of the beast. Doesn't make you a bad person, doesn't make you inadequate, and it's not a reflection on your upbringing or on your teachers or on your rabbi. It's just the way it is. You never, ever get it all right. So when you study halacha, be prepared to find out you're doing something wrong. It's okay. And I think it's important for a person to actually be in a state of interest to find out what he can do better. I've always pointed out that the difference between an Am Haaretz and a Talmud Chacham, the difference between, loosely translated, an ignoramus on the one hand and a Talmud Chacham, loosely translated, a Torah scholar, on the other hand, is not the volume of information contained in a person's head, but rather the attitude that a person has towards halachic observance. That to the degree that a person hears a detail and dismisses it as insignificant, I never did it, why should I bother now? And that's just some kind of rabbi's idea of another way to control my life, or whatever it is, that is the attitude of an Am HaAretz. And you can know a lot, you can be very familiar and be very observant and be a classic Am HaAretz, someone who disregards the significance of detail in halacha. And you can actually be very ignorant of halacha, and in my book, and I think actually I get this from reliable sources, and actually be a Talmud Chacham, someone who is eager to grow and absorb information and to relate to halacha in a way that says that it is my guide in life. And when a person is that way, then you know, you can find out that you've been observing Shabbos for 20 years and you didn't realize that the way you're doing the challenge actually has some defects in it. Nothing wrong with that, it's the way it goes. I found out 4 years ago that there's a major difference of opinion about the plastic bag that covers the challah on Shabbos that I never knew about. I just didn't know about it. What can I tell you? So maybe it was a little more than 4 years ago. So, there's that one opinion, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach holds that a twistum on a plastic bag is actually prohibited to open on Shabbos because he maintains that the twistum has rendered the bag into a non-vessel, because while it's on, the bag is not useful to put in and take things out. And as you untwist the twistum and open the bag, you're creating a vessel. The bag is created each time you do that. And so he maintains that you can't do that, and the only way to get a challah out of such a bag is to rip the bag off the challah, so to speak, which makes me look like an uncivilized boor in front of my guests.
You can't take it out early?
You could take it, do that too, but
that's
then it gets
practical.
Stale.
That's
then it gets
practical.
Stale, then
there's, there's no discussion.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so that's okay. Good. So enough deviation. It's now 8:21, and I've done the same thing I did last night. Yes.
Small hole. Yeah. You do it in a can, small hole, and take twist them off, or is it twist them itself a problem?
If the hole makes the bag useless as a container, which it got to be a pretty big hole, because a small hole makes it useless. But with a bag, a small hole still, the bag is useful. It's just a question of how it works. Okay, so now we're going to go. So the thing is, we're talking over here, when we're talking about reheating foods on Shabbos, by definition, we're not talking about the d'oraisa of bishul, which means, what is bishul? Bishul is cooking. What is cooking? Cooking is defined as the application of heat to a food that renders it edible, or that transforms it into a different state. Okay, that's what cooking is, at least when it comes to dry food. So you have a raw piece of meat, you apply heat to it, you can't eat it when it's raw. I mean, you can physically get it into your stomach, but it's not what we consider edible. The application of heat transforms the properties of a food to a sufficient degree, and that's called cooking. We're not talking about that. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about foods that have already been cooked, or foods that are going to be treated in such a way that they're not going to be cooked. And we're talking about prohibitions that the rabbis instituted, that even though the Torah would not have prohibited it, and it doesn't fit the category of cooking, it's still prohibited because it relates to cooking, or it could cause you to cook, or it looks like cooking, and you'll think that cooking is okay. So, the Torah prohibitions of with heat are baking, cooking, roasting, raw food. Or, that's the case for dry foods. Now with liquids, you understand that liquids are a totally different concept when it comes to cooking, because let's just take water, which is the easiest thing to deal with in terms of the contrast. Water, when you heat up water, yes, it's true that eventually it'll turn into a gas called steam when it gets to 212 degrees. But it's not true that the heated water has changed its property. It's just that same water is just very hot, and so you're not cooking water. You're boiling it, which is different. You're heating it up to the boiling point. It's not the transformation of the water. Proof is that if you stick it outside in an Arctic day or put it in the freezer, it will go back to its original state pretty quickly. So therefore, the water has not been transformed. If you cook chicken and put it outside, it doesn't go back to being raw. It just gets to be cold cooked chicken. But water goes back to being raw water. It's just not cooked anymore. So therefore, water can be cooked many times. Dry goods cannot be cooked many times. They can only be cooked once. Once it's cooked, it's cooked. can't recook something. And therefore, you can't, if you take a cooked chicken, you cannot cook it again and violate. There's no way to violate it according to Torah law. This chicken, you cook your goose, that's it. You can only violate Shabbos once on every chicken. Once you cook it, it's over. You can't squeeze in any more violations on it because it's already cooked. Whereas with water, you can violate Shabbos again and again and again. Every time it cools down, cook it up again, and then it's another violation. So the point is that Torah prohibitions are cooking with dry food once, or heating up liquids once they're cooled down. The rabbis come along with a number of prohibitions. And the prohibitions are instituted either because they say that the following action looks so much like cooking that if this is allowed, you will forget the difference between it and cooking, and you'll think that cooking itself is allowed because you grew up and your mother always did this. She always did this because it's allowed. But you think she did it because cooking is allowed, and then you go and cook. So therefore, we don't want this action, we'll describe it, we don't want this action to look to mislead the Jewish people into cooking inappropriately. Therefore, we're going to prohibit this because it looks like cooking. Or they're afraid that a specific act might cause you to forget and you'll come to inadvertently violate Shabbos that while you're doing that act. And therefore, they instituted certain prohibitions or certain mechanisms to make sure that you can't come to do that. So the rabbinic prohibitions we're going to talk about are Shehiyah. That's, I'm looking at Roman numeral 2, letter B, small letter A. Shehiyah is literally holding on or keeping on, which means uncooked food that is left on an open fire from before Shabbos is called Shehiyah, which means you shohev the food, you keep the food on, or you place it on the fire before Shabbos, and you leave it on Shabbos. Now, there's nothing wrong with that according to Torah law. Why? Because what did you do on Shabbos? Nothing. You were taking a nap. The food was placed on the range before Shabbos. It transformed all by itself. Any action that you did was done before Shabbos. You did not cook. The food did get cooked, but you didn't cook it. Therefore, you didn't do anything. And according to Torah law, there'd be no problem. The food got cooked on Shabbos, and who cares? You didn't cook it. It got cooked. The food is not Jewish. You're Jewish. Doesn't really care if the food gets cooked, as long as you don't cook it. So therefore, it would not be prohibited. But the rabbis prohibited it because they do not want you to come and adjust the flame, which is a typical part of the cooking process. If you have food that you care about, you check it, and as you check it, you say, oops, it's cooking too fast, or it's cooking too slow. So you'll put out the fire, or you'll stir the coals to create more heat, or you'll say it's uneven, you'll move it over to another part. And therefore, you'll get involved in enhancing the cooking process, and that will be a Torah prohibition because you'll be doing something, even though it's already cooking without you. But anything that a person does to speed up or more evenly apply or just enhance the process of cooking itself is a Torah prohibition.
So you can't stir the chalent.
You cannot stir the chalent. That is correct. Stirring the chalent is probably a Torah violation, even if it's cooked already. While it's on the fire. While it's on the fire. Thank you very much. Cannot stir the chalent. That's it. So that's under the rubric of helping something cook. There are a lot of other things, by the way, there that are very innocent and innocuous that people inadvertently do on Shabbos that they don't realize, such as just putting a lid back on a pot which is on the fire because you're creating a sealed environment. And the sealed environment will cook better because it's hotter. Your heat can't escape. So you have to be very careful about returning a lid to a pot which is on the fire on Shabbos because it almost always will make it more efficient in cooking. So we'll get to that. We'll get to how you do that.
Can you take the top off the pot when it's on the fire?
You mean to make it not burn?
To do something to change.
Well, I can't imagine how taking the pot off the fire, while it might improve the process, I can't imagine how it would. It doesn't speed up the cooking. It doesn't apply the heat. It doesn't reduce the flame. And therefore, I don't see what the problem is. I don't know practically what it does. I don't know what it does.
What taking the lid off?
Yeah. What is the lid taking the lid off do to benefit the food?
Allow the water to evaporate, so it would be less liquidy.
Uh-huh. Right. So it'll allow the water to evaporate. Well, the water will evaporate slower. It'll just escape, is what you mean, right?
Right.
Right. Yeah. I think that's intended for me because I was coughing. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
The water will condensate on the top of the lid and
then fall back in. Whereas if you remove the lid, it'll escape. Right. So that's an interesting question. I don't see what that does, though. Although it does allow it to escape. Interesting. So it might help. So therefore, it'll get drier, and therefore, it'll cook faster. So
it won't cook faster. It's just if you want it drier.
Well, it will cook faster if the water is eventually eliminated.
That's true.
I don't know about that. I'm not aware in halacha of a prohibition of taking off a lid. I haven't seen any of the Afanim talk about that. But it seems to make a little sense that if taking it off, put it this way, taking it off purposely for a while might get into that question. If you're taking it off for a minute, I can't see how that's going to improve the cooking. But putting it back on clearly will, because at the state where it's off, it won't cook as well, and you're putting it back on, so that's the problem. So the bottom line is, the answer is you're going to do this off the fire. That's all. But we'll talk about how to get it off the fire, put it back on. Okay. So shahiyah is leaving uncooked food on an open fire. Why? Because we're afraid that through the food being left on this open fire, you'll look at it and you'll come to enhance the cooking process by stirring up the coals or turning up the flame or putting on more firewood or something like that. So therefore the rabbi said, in order to leave food in an oven or in a stove on Shabbos, we want you to take away the fuel. We want you to take out the wood supply or the coals. Just remove it. So now you have a hot oven because you had a lot of heat in there, and now you can leave the food in the oven, and there's nothing that you can do about it, because if you want it to cook faster, no one's going to go and get firewood and put it into an oven that is so clearly different than a normal oven stove, because it's because it doesn't have any fuel in it. So that alone, the fact that it's so different, will be a recognition that something different is occurring here, and you'll realize, oh, it's because of Shabbos, therefore, of course, there's no fuel here. So therefore, they said under those conditions you can leave food in an oven because there's no fuel. You can cover the fuel. You can block access to the fuel by putting something on top of it. So we'll see how that works nowadays. A second prohibition that we're going to talk about is chazara, which is an entirely different issue, which is assuming that the food is on the flame properly before Shabbos, is over a heat source as Shabbos begins properly, and now is removed, how and under what conditions can you put the food back on the place that it was up until now? You've taken it off of its heat source, now you want to put it back on the heat source. How can you do that? Alternatively, it's not just returning food to a place where it was, but it means restoring it to a cooking condition again for the second time in its life, which means cooked food in the refrigerator, which is cold, never was on the flame for Shabbos, never was on any kind of a range, never was exposed to heat this Shabbos. It was cooked on Thursday or Friday, and then it's in the fridge and it's cold. And now you want to expose it to heat on Shabbos, so you're not going to be able to violate cooking because it's already cooked. So it shouldn't be a problem. But the rabbis are concerned that it looks like cooking, that putting something on a flame on Shabbos, even though you can't cook it anymore because it's already fully cooked, so there's no Torah violation, but it looks like cooking because people see you taking food, putting it in a pan, putting it on the flame, and cooking it. It looks like it's cooking. So if you can do that, people won't know the difference between that and real cooking, and they'll say that if this is okay, then that's okay, and they'll come to cook. So therefore, the sages prohibited that which looks like cooking, which means that there are going to be major loopholes. If you can get it near the fire or on the fire in a way that doesn't look like cooking, like it looks weird or inefficient or, just bizarre, then they're not worried about it because you're not cooking. You really aren't cooking. They were just worried about looking like cooking. So they say, make sure to do it in a way that doesn't look like cooking. So that's chazara. That's called chazara, or modern Hebrew, or properly pronounced Hebrew, would be chazara. Returning something to the fire, returning meaning either returning it to its visit with fire for a second time because it was once cooked and now it's off the fire and you're putting it onto the fire for the first time, or you've removed it from the fire where it was properly placed and now you've taken it off and you want to be able to put it back. Under what conditions can you do that? That's called chazara. Hatmana, we're not going to really get to it tonight at all. Hatmana is the insulating of food, and the sages prohibited enclosing foodstuffs in certain materials that not only prevent heat escape, but also actually enhance the process of cooking the food, and the sages were concerned that it looks like cooking, and they prohibited that. We're going to talk about that because that has some very practical applications, but almost none of that will occur tonight. So now let's talk. We're looking at row numeral number 3.
Whoa.
I'm sorry.
For instance, you say you cannot take food out of the refrigerator so that you can have warm food for Shabbos. What can you do?
You can, but here's exactly what we're talking about. Number 3. I was just outlining the rabbinic prohibitions and what the concepts are. I wasn't really giving a lot of halacha about how to do it. Now we're going to get into what you can do, what you can't do. So number 3, I introduced the concept, the term called nesina lechatchila. Nesina from the verb naton, which means to place. Lechatchila is the halachic a term for the ideal before the fact initiative that you're allowed to do without any questions. So nesina lechatchila means placing cooked food on the fire. Under what conditions can you place cooked food on the fire? There are many, many cases where you cannot. So the only conditions under which you can place it on the fire would be if you're doing something which is not normal cooking. So I've listed over here what I found to be 5 different things. There are probably more, or there are variations on the same thing. Number 1 is kedera al gabi kedera. Kedera means a pot, al gabi on top of, or in back of, meaning on top of kedera, another pot. So you have one pot here, and you have another pot here. This pot is properly on the fire, and now you have food in a pot. It's cold. You want to heat it. You take it and you place it on top of the other pot. That's not normal cooking, and therefore you're allowed to do it. The food is fully cooked. It's placed in a vessel or a wrapper like aluminum foil, and that's placed on top of another pot, which itself is on a heat source. The heat of the blower pot is transferred to the upper container, and it receives heat, and that is okay, because that's not normal cooking. That's not michzi kemavasho. It does not look like cooking. So that's one way to get food heated on Shabbos. We're talking about dry food. Why aren't we talking about liquid or dry food with lots of liquid on it? Because the liquid is subject to a Torah violation of cooking. And if you expose it to a heat source, which will bring it up to Yad Soletisbo, which is the temperature that a hand will withdraw quickly from touching because it's that hot, which many authorities would say is as low as 110 degrees. So if you get water to that temperature on Shabbos, you violated cooking. So therefore, we're only talking about dry goods, because dry goods can't be cooked a second time, at least not easily. I actually could. I'll explain that in a minute. But the liquids can be cooked, and therefore you can't do that with liquids because you're going to get them to a temperature that's too hot. Yes?
This is one of the things that's always been a problem. You know, you said dry goods without a lot of liquid. How do you define that?
So I can tell you what I see in the poskim, more than a general rule. First of all, the idea is that if there's always moisture, for example, chicken has moisture on it. It has fat that's hardened on it, and so on and so forth. So if the volume of the liquid associated with this dry food is such that it's not really considered significant. It's really just the chicken. It just happens to have touched or absorbed or have on its surface a little bit of this. That's not considered significant, and we're not concerned about that. The halacha is concerned about it, however, when the volume of the liquid that's on this thing is such that you would note it as a separate entity. So lots of fat sticking to the chicken should be a problem, and therefore you would just flick it off with a fork or something before you ever expose it to the heat, so you're not allowing that volume of potential liquid to be heated. A classic example that the poskim give that is a problem would be ice crystals forming on a challah that you want to defrost. It's a fully baked challah, and you want to get it warm for lunch, and you take it out of the freezer, and for reasons that I don't understand, the crystals are formed all over it, even though you did everything possible for it not to happen. And so that water is considered to be not batel to the challah, not inconsequential, and therefore the halacha wants you to get those ice crystals off before you put it on the thing.
But how about if you have something like you had chicken and you sautéed onions,
mm-hmm.
and you want to heat up the chicken with sautéed onions?
Onions are dry food.
They're dry food, but they're a little bit greasy.
Yeah, that's okay. That's considered to be a dry food.
Right.
Yeah, we're talking about liquids. Really liquids.
Roast beef and gravy
or fat or soup. Soup, there's no way to get soup as hot as you want to have it if it hasn't been on the fire from before Shabbos, because soup is liquid and it's gonna boil up. It's gonna get cooked. So you can't, there's no, even kedera gabi kedera, if the soup gets as hot as you really want to have hot soup on Shabbos, then by definition you've just cooked it again, so it's a problem. So soups will be a classic example of typical example of a problem. Okay, yes,
I'm sorry. Does the fire have to have food in it?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes and no, which it depends who you ask, which means it's a machlokas achronim. As a matter of fact, I just checked this afternoon because the question came up this morning and someone claimed that they saw one thing. Anyway, I just checked. So the practice is to be lenient on that, not to require food in the bottom thing. You will find people say it has to have food. That's because they've been taught by some poskim or some students of poskim that they have to. It's machlokas achronim, but they're very reliable poskim to say you do not have to have food in the bottom pot. So, well, there are lots of pots that are invulnerable to this kind of heat. So, for example, let's say you have a hot plate, which is fairly hot, or even a range. So you invert a pot with no food on it, and that's the first pot. Then the second pot is whatever you have, your chicken in the pot, and you put it on top of the inverted pot, and now you have a kedera al gabi kedera, and you're heating, and the food is fully cooked before it ever got there, so you're not advancing the cooking process, you're just heating it up, and that's okay, because it's a kedera gabi kedera, and it's not a normal way of cooking. Yes?
What defines a pot?
Something other... not a cake pan, not a cookie pan. Aluminum pan that are very flat, no. It's got to really be something that's worthy of being like a container. Yeah, that would be good. A roaster pan would be good, inverting that. That would be good. A roaster pan would be fine. But these flat cookie sheets, or even these, shall we say, the pizza pie things, those are probably not acceptable. Because what you're really doing is... you know that it's a pot, but the fact is that it's just another cooking surface. So halacha says that doesn't look abnormal. That's not an abnormal way of cooking.
Something that would actually cook something.
That's right. Something which clearly is not meant to be the surface that you're going to cook on, because it's clearly defined as something else.
Okay, so, this is different from like taking your soup and, you know, like with one of the electric flex you plug in. We're differentiating, is that correct?
Differentiating between...
what you just said, you're warming something up Shabbat
right.
afternoon, and you're
putting it on...
You have your soup as hot as you want and putting it on... what do you call those?
Before Shabbat?
Yes.
Yeah, so... that's
like a hundred
so, leaving food on some properly prepared surface before Shabbos is great. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about you here. Yeah.
But so I'm sorry to be picky about
it's
this,
okay.
But say there was chicken with gravy
yes.
that you couldn't heat up, obviously, because of the gravy.
Yeah.
But if you had one of those hot plates that really just got to, like, warmed, you know, like...
Right. So if it can't get to...
mildly warm, not
so,
hot.
Right. So if it can't get to... did you hear the question? It's an important question. If you have an electric utensil that is capable of producing heat but not intense heat, so that the gravy and the chicken would be heated up to a comfortably warm temperature, but not yet to lettuce, but right, tepid. That's okay, because it's all, the only way you can violate cooking liquid is to bring it to Yad to lettuce bow, is to bring it to 110 degrees, minimally, some would say even more, 20 degrees. So therefore, When you get, by the way, 105 degrees is very comfortably warm. 106 degrees, you'd be surprised. I learned this very, very directly when we talked about the mikveh, the women's mikveh, which is supposedly perfectly automatically modulated in terms of its temperature, and we have it set for 103 degrees. The women's mikveh. Now your body is 98.6 average, so 103 degrees feels very warm, not uncomfortable. But you go to 106, it's amazing how sensitive the human skin is. You get to 106, you start getting uncomfortable. A bath at home is probably not 106 degrees. We've had cases where the mikveh has gotten too hot, and we've discovered that it's only 2 or 3 degrees more than what it's supposed to be. So it's an amazing thing, the human skin. Anyway, so to answer you directly, if you use an electric implement that is not capable of producing heat, of yahdzeit lenisbo, then it is okay, because you're not cooking. The food itself, for sure you're not cooking. And it's not a cooking implement. It's not a cooking implement. Now, there's another problem, which has to do with whether or not that hot plate is has controls on it. Because if it does, you can't use it unless you've properly prepared it with a blech, which we'll get into. That's a separate issue. So it's two issues. One is the act of heating something on Shabbos in a way that does or does not look like you're cooking. That's called chazara. Introducing something to a fire once it was not on the fire. And then there's the issue of shahia, which is what kind of fire are you allowed to use altogether on Shabbos based on the issue of maybe you might adjust the flame. So if something has controls, it's adjustable, then you have to properly prepare it so that you, the halacha is not concerned that you're going to come to adjust the controls or the flame. We're going to get to that.
Are we going to talk also about using timers for those kinds of things?
Did I put timers in here? I had timers in the, I hope we're going to get timers. The bottom line is that you can use it, but it's going to be a pretty, it's not going to be worth it. Halacha ruins the value of a timer. Can be done. Anyway, so number, we're going on 3B over here, and for the benefit of those on the tape, don't worry, you're not missing too much. So 3B is near a fire, which means that you're taking food out of the fridge and you're putting it near a heat source, and that's okay, which means you're not allowed to take food and expose it directly to a fire. That you can't do, because that's like cooking. But
when you say fire, are you
an electric range?
Oven? Let's talk about stove.
Okay. I'm not talking about oven yet. So near a fire, what I mean is that if you have a blech on a fire, you're going to take the food out of the fridge and you're going to put it on the blech in the area of the blech, which never is capable of producing the intense heat that we're worried about. Or you're going to place it off the blech in such a way that the in such a way that it could never reach intense heat. That kind of exposure to fire, which will give it warmth, but it will never give it intense heat of yahdzeit lenisbo, is allowed. So therefore, that would be another way of getting food warm on Shabbos, which is you're not really putting it on the fire, and you're not putting it on a blech, and you're just putting it near a fire, but it can't be so near that that it could theoretically come to that temperature if you left it there for a couple hours. Another way of putting something on a fire is if you left it there with a blech, which we'll talk about very clearly in a minute. Okay. A blech-like utensil, which would be a hot plate with no controls, also is a good way of getting food heated on Shabbos. Another way of getting food heated on Shabbos is a kli rishon off the fire, which means that if you want to take fully cooked food and immerse it in hot water, which is not on the fire, which means the hot water itself is not being cooked, so that's another way of getting that fully cooked food hot. So, for example, a classic example is cooked noodles, which are cold, you want to place them in hot soup. That's okay, because the soup is off the fire, and the soup is going to make the noodles very hot. But it's okay, because the noodles were cooked already, and you're not doing something that looks like cooking because you're not putting it on the fire. So therefore, it's okay. Now, what did I say in E? Hot water
is
off
the fire on the blech?
Is the fire on the blech? No, is the fire on the What fire?
You were shown off the fire. If you had soup and you wanted...
Yes.
I never heard about this.
Oh, yeah. So you have noodles that are cold, and you introduce them to the hot soup, which is off the fire.
It's off the fire. That's what cools the soup, though.
Yeah, well...
Let me tell you
what else cools the soup. If you eat it, it'll cool the soup. But as long as it's hot when you eat it, you don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, you know. Okay. I don't know why I put E. E is really redundant. Hot water off the fire. I don't know what I said that for. I don't know what I meant by that.
Well, maybe you can pour it. I've poured hot water on noodles.
Right, which is okay, which is really what D is. So I don't know why I said E. I don't know what I was doing there. Okay. Anyway, you got the idea. Those are cases where that's how to heat up food. Now, we're going to get to chazara in a minute, which means food that was on a source of heat and is now taken off in order to serve it, and you want to return it to the source of heat for later. As an example would be, your favorite nephew has arrived on Friday night at 10 o'clock, and he loves your challah, but he won't be there for lunch. So you want to give him some of your challah. So you take it off the fire to give him some challah. How do you put it back on the fire so you can have it still heated for the next day? So we'll talk about that in a minute. That's also a form of chazara. That's where you're putting it back in the heat.
Take it off and giving some, or can you just reach in the pot?
You can't really. When you have food on the fire, you're not allowed to go out from it while it's on the fire because it involves stirring. You're picking up some good things here. I mean, you're asking the right questions.
Where
all right. We're at Roman numeral 4.
I'm correcting mistakes.
Yeah. Well, Shahia. Shahia is uncooked food left on the fire. So we said that what the sages don't want is that somebody will leave food uncooked on the fire on Shabbos, and therefore when Shabbos comes they'll have a need or a desire to improve the fire or affect the cooking. And therefore they said don't do it. Unless it is something. Unless what? So let's pause here for a minute and just get this in your head. Get this image. You have two rabbis, two Tanayim. We have two major opinions in the Gemara. It's a big machlokas. It's not resolved because there's an argument in the halachic authorities which of these opinions to follow. One group, that's called the Rabbanan, they say that the only food that can be left on a fire when Shabbos begins is food that is fully cooked. You have to have fully cooked food left on the fire. Anything less than fully cooked cannot be left on an open fire on Shabbos because you might tend to adjust the fire in order to fully cook it. Once it's fully cooked, we're not afraid you're going to forget about Shabbos and cook because it's done already. You're relaxed. You're happy. The food is fully cooked. You're not going to do anything on Shabbos. So the rabbis say that the rabbis don't mind. The halacha does not mind leaving fully cooked food on the Shabbos. But less than fully cooked, you cannot leave it on a flame as Shabbos begins without certain mechanisms in place. Hananya comes along and says, no, as long as the food is partially cooked, you can leave it on the flame without any special arrangements. Now, what's the partially cooked? So within that, there's an argument at what partially cooked is. Some say half cooked, some say a third cooked. You might hear people mumbling, just want to familiarize you with the terms, kamaicha ben drusai. And like I always point out, whenever you talk about halachic terms, you're not supposed to pronounce them properly because then somebody might know what you mean. So we always mumble them. So you say, you go to the rabbi and you say, I'm talking about Kamaachal ben Drusai, and you're standing around listening, you don't know what they're saying. Kamaachal ben Drusai, which means like the food of ben Drusai, who was a bandit, who ate, he and everybody like him, eats on the run. Because they're always ready to run from the law and from people, and therefore they eat fast. So they cook something, expose it to fire, as soon as it gets just edible, they get out of there, and they move on. So therefore, it's called Kamaachal ben Drusai. So that's a definition of cooking because there's a group of human beings that actually considers that sufficient. It's fast food. So how much is that? I always say obviously they cannot be Jewish because Jews like their food burnt. It's unbelievable. I had a French waiter who told me that when a Jew says well done, he means burnt, and when he says rare, he means well done. Anyway.
Not me. Anyhow.
And as far as I'm concerned, Goyim like to eat Eidel and Achai. I mean, they like the animal to be walking off the table. Anyway, so
eating like a bandit means something different in Jewish.
That's right. It's called Kamaachal ben Drusai, like the food of ben Drusai. And so Hananya's opinion is partially cooked is enough for it to be left on the fire without any special things, because the sages are no longer worried that you're going to come to stir it, because it's already well on its way. Now, there's an argument about whether that's a third cooked, which is a very lenient opinion, because that's less cooked, or a half cooked, which is a little stricter, because you need more cooking in order to leave it on the fire. Now, of course, if you disagree with Hananya, then you hold like the Rabbanan, and the rabbis hold it had to be fully cooked in order to leave it on the fire. So I'm familiarizing you with these opinions because these opinions actually find their way all the way down in the halacha, and there are actually people today who paskin, who say that the halacha is like the Rabbanan, that it has to be fully cooked in order to leave it on the fire, and there are others who say, nah. Now, because of the intersection between Shehiyah, which is leaving food on a fire as Shabbos begins, which has its set of concerns, and Chazara, which is returning something to its source of fire on Shabbos once you've taken it off, because of the intersection of all the concerns, Halacha strongly recommends that you leave no food on the fire as Shabbos begins that's not fully cooked. It solves a lot of problems. There are, however, many reasons for leniency if the food that you leave on the fire as Shabbos begins is less than fully cooked. So let's go through an order. We're Roman numeral 4 now. Okay, uncooked food left on the fire, that's the prohibition of Shehiyah, of leaving something on the fire. So the sages said, the halacha says, that the modern day equivalent of garuf, cleaned out, or katum, or covered over, meaning having the coals removed, which is what the sages want you to do to protect you from the inadvertent stirring of the coals, or covering it. The modern day equivalent is covering your flame or range with a blech, with a covering, a metal covering or an asbestos covering that blocks access to the fire. Now, the fact is that we don't adjust the fire at the fire. Nowadays, we adjust the fire at the controls. So, A, many authorities say, that's right, therefore you should cover the controls too. We know you need to cover the fire, even though you don't adjust the fire at the fire, because the main point of the covering is to remind you that something is different. And so the reminder occurs where the cooking is. So therefore, the pot is on a flame, but it's got this ridiculous asbestos thing between it and the flame that reminds you that this is not normal, then you won't come to adjust it. But most poskim say, or a significant amount of poskim say, I didn't do a count, that you should cover the knobs as well, the controls as well, because that would be the place where the sages want you to have a covering to block access to adjusting the fire. So therefore, that's called a blech. So, when you leave food on the stove for Shabbos, you should leave it on the stove. Number one is it should be fully cooked. Number two is you want to leave it on a blech. Mostly, why do you have a blech? Why do you have a blech? Because the truth is we don't care. It's fully cooked. You can leave it on that way already. But if you take it off the fire on Shabbos, you're not going to be able to put it back unless there's a blech. So therefore, you want the blech to allow yourself to take it off and put it back. If it's not fully cooked, you want a blech, because many opinions would hold that if it's less than fully cooked, you're not allowed to leave it on the fire at all on Shabbos. So therefore, you really always want a blech, and you ideally want to have it fully cooked, but if it's not fully cooked, it's not so terrible. Certainly, if it's half cooked, there are many, many, many responsible opinions that say that it doesn't need a blech at all. But so, and even if it's a third cooked, there are many responsible opinions that say you don't need a blech at all. So therefore, what's that? An electric blech.
They have these large ones. They're like a big rectangle.
You mean this Kedera blech thing?
Yeah.
This thing that fills with water?
No, it's not water.
You mean a hot plate?
Yeah, but it's supposed to... Right, it has no control.
Oh, very good. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That is itself blech. Because since there's nothing to adjust, there's no worry.
But it gets really hot.
Well, that's okay.
I didn't feel comfortable.
I know, but that's okay because, again, the whole point is you're allowed to leave food on a range on Shabbos when it has a blech, even if it's very hot. Right? A blech, also, food on top of a fire that's separated from the fire by a blech also gets very hot. There's nothing wrong with that. So you can leave food on a very hot plate that has no controls. That's considered to be a blech.
Okay, now,
Before Shabbos. Thank you.
You need the inverted pot for that.
What's that? No, you don't need an inverted pot. That is a blech. The inverted pot is what you're doing when you don't have a blech, and you're now introducing it for the first time on Shabbos, so we create a way that's not normal cooking, and therefore it doesn't look like cooking, therefore it's not prohibited. The inverted pot is not necessary if you're leaving food on a blech as Shabbos begins, so then the food can be on the blech, which is very close to the fire.
So you
not cold food and
that's right. That's taking right. Cold food
what
cannot be introduced
controls?
To a blech for the first time on Shabbos. What?
Are you supposed to cover? So you are supposed to cover the controls.
Yes. Yes. It's strongly recommended. If you did not cover the controls, do not let anybody tell you that you're a bad person. But
I'm not worried about my ego. I just want to worry about what I'm supposed to do.
I understand.
Are you covering
the controls, even the ones that you're not using? Meaning, if you have the controls for each flame, let's say.
No. You would only need to cover the controls that would be relevant to what you're cooking on. So if you have four ranges and four controls, you can cover just the controls that you would want to adjust. I don't think halacha is worried that you're going to. That's like a totally different equation.
Turn on an empty fire.
Right. Isn't that right? No. That's right.
Now, what about a crock pot?
Yeah.
So if you plug it in.
Yes.
And you cover your controls.
Yes.
Where's your bluff?
So the first of all, if the you may not need a blech in terms of shahia, in terms of leaving it on, because it could very often be fully cooked or significantly cooked. But let's assume you want to have a blech. The blech in a crock pot, and let's assume we're talking about a crock pot which sits on a bottom, right? And you take it off, put it back, and so on and so forth. So the blech would be, the ideal blech is a piece of aluminum foil between it's resting on this on the electronic bottom under the pot. Yes.
On the base of the pot.
Yes, and it doesn't ruin anything.
So what's the?
Even if your
chowin
is not fully cooked.
If your chowin is fully cooked, which eliminates any problem of leaving food on a range on Shabbos, we still recommend to have a blech. But specifically because you want to be able to take your chowin off and put it back on. There's no way to take something off of a heat source and return it to that heat source unless there's a blech. It's one of the major conditions. So therefore, the only way to put the chowin back on that thing, even if you never put it down, is to have a blech there. So it's not that critical. Again, it's a good practice to always set up your chowin pot with a blech, because you may be dealing with a late Friday afternoon where you started cooking late, it didn't reach a significant stage of cooking beforehand, and the sages did prohibit leaving something directly on a fire source when it's not cooked enough. So because of that, it's nice to have the practice of always using a blech. But indeed, if you know that your thing is fully cooked or significantly cooked, and you also don't care if you're going to be able to put it back once you take it off on Shabbos afternoon for lunch, you really don't need a blech because it's already reached the stage. You know.
Okay, now this hot plate again that we said is a blech. Can you take something Shabbos morning and put it on from the refrigerator or no? Or do you let it get room temperature?
The food, a cold food from the fridge put on a hot plate that will reach yadso lettuce bug, that you cannot do it. If the hot plate is capable of making it yadso lettuce bug, you cannot introduce it to the fire for the first time on Shabbos. Because the sages said, okay, you don't have an exposed flame here. We're not worried that you're going to adjust the controls, because you can't. But we are worried that it looks like cooking, because this hot plate is a cooking device, because it gets so hot. You can cook on it. Therefore, we do not want you to put food. So then you do the inverted pot, and therefore now it doesn't look like cooking. You're getting the heat you want, or a lot of it, but you're not doing an action which looks like cooking, and therefore you've not violated what we call chazara. It's like a flat thing. That's not good, because it's very much like a cooking surface. So you want to use a pot. You want to use a pot. Okay. I have a feeling of confusion. Yeah.
Let's say a kugel, like a salad.
Yeah.
Onto a blech that's going to make it yadso lettuce bug, that you should overturn a pot.
Yeah, you need a kedera agave kedera. Yes, that's correct.
And what about, did we talk about crock pots with isters yet?
No, we didn't. That's a hatmana issue. And what she's talking about is the crock pot where you're inserting the pot into an outer shell, which itself is a heating thing. Mm-hmm. So there also, the blech for that would be a lining over the entire inside, but there's also a hatmana issue, which is that you're, when you put the thing back, you're enclosing it in a wrapper, so to speak, that adds heat to it, and which is a, we're not going to deal with that issue tonight. But when you do have that kind of shell, just practically, without getting into the science of it or the halachic science of it, you do want to line the entire inside and have the lining over, drape over the outside a little bit so you can see that there's a lining there.
Lining of aluminum foil?
Aluminum foil, yeah.
But if you have a simple one, it's just the hot, yeah. You put a slayer
that's right.
of foil.
Foil, that's it.
And that's
it. And then you got it.
What about those prop parts that are a single piece?
So that they're a big problem because there's almost no way to serve from them without stirring, and you're stirring something which is on the heat source. So those are big problems. You really do not want crock pots that have a built-in bottom.
What about those liners?
Bags. Can they be used as a blech?
You can just lift everything and put it in a different...
Oh, that's great. That's great. You mean, so you're putting... all the food goes in a plastic bag, which goes in the thing.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. We still got a problem. Still have a problem. Still a problem, because what you're doing is you're still cooking without a blech. See, you're still cooking without a blech. Your pot is still the crock pot. What you're doing is you found a way to put the food in the crock pot without messing up the pot. But you're still cooking in a pot which itself is directly on the fire. So it's still a problem. You understand what I'm saying?
That's just without the removable.
Yes. It can't be the bluff because it's not separating between the pot which is doing the cooking and the fire. You see, you're still... This is just an interesting way that you're cooking, but you still have the pot on a heat source, and there's no separation between the heat source and the pot.
The plastic itself?
Yeah, but the pot is the blech. That's what.
You're going to make the pot into the blech because you're saying that the food is in a plastic.
The pot is the plastic bag.
Pot. The food is in a plastic pot, and the pot is. I don't think that's the way it works. I think, halachically speaking, what we're talking here is that the pot is the cooking utensil.
Yeah, but the food is not touching the pot.
The food is not touching the pot. That's correct, but it's in the pot, and the pot is still what's cooking the food. See, it's not that the bag is cooking the food. The pot is cooking the food. I'll look into that.
They recommend with those bags that you put water on the outside of the bag. Like you take the crock pot, you put water
in, and then the bag, right?
The bag, yeah. I don't know if that makes sense.
Maybe it does.
Is there any problem inherent in doing that? Where the water would be heated up before Shabbat started anyway?
No, there's not. No, because the water is heated up to let us go before Shabbos. All right, let's go. We're running late. All right, so this is where we're going to stop. We've got quite a bit to do. But you got the general idea. What we'll do is we'll pick up next week with the Roman numeral 4 again. We'll try to back up and go through that. We'll go through Chazara, and we'll get into the timers, and we'll probably go into a little bit of Hatmana. Okay? Yes?
At the bottom of the sheet, it says, yeah, so let's go 160. Is that 5106?
No, 160. Yeah, well, let me see how I can... there are different temperatures of Yad Soled Espo, and depending on what we're talking about, we have to take the strictest interpretation. So, when we're trying to determine if something should not be heated, we take the lowest temperature, because that's the strictest thing. We don't want it to get this hot, because that the lowest temperature is the strictest interpretation of how hot it shouldn't get. When we're trying to talk about something which has already been reached a certain heat, and therefore it's not subject to cooking anymore, so then we take the maximum temperature because we're afraid that it has not been cooked the first time. So in certain areas we take the maximum temperature, in certain areas we take the minimum temperature. So I'll give you working scenarios for that next week so you can see exactly how it works. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. Thank you.